from KQED.
And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and for the rest of this hour, we're talking food and drink, specifically ones created right here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And it goes way beyond sourdough bread, let me tell you, or itzits for that matter. We're talking cioppino, chop suey, martinis, and a whole lot more. And joining us to talk about these iconic San Francisco Bay Area foods, Susie Rocho, our own KQED producer. Also, yes, hello there. And I should just say, Susie is constantly bringing us treats that she makes herself. Today, we have some of these treats that we're going to be talking about, including fortune cookies and itzits. But she is the producer and director for KQED's California Report and producer of KQED's Golden State Plate series. And also joining us, Laura Smith Borman. She is the author of iconic San Francisco dishes, drinks, and desserts. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And you did bring some treats for us here. I see some Green Goddess dressing. I see fortune cookies. What else is in there?
We have fortune cookies, a special little sesame fortune cookie. Oh. It's I go nowhere without food.
Okay, well, let's see if that it gets eaten or melts before the end of the half hour here. Let me begin with you, Susie. What was the sort of the concept behind the series you're doing, the Golden State Plate series?
So on the California Report, we've been doing like a lot of 30-minute documentaries, a lot of really serious stuff, you know, about the migrants at the border and, you know, postpartum psychosis. And I think as a staff, we all felt like we also need to bring some joy into our lives and as well as our listeners.
Some nourishment.
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, it was kind of a thing that, like, we talk about food all the time. And it was one of those things that we need to kind of delve into this history that people think they know about the things that they eat every day, but they really don't. You know, like one of the first stories we did was about Green Goddess dressing. And Laura was actually a part of that story. Sasha Coca, our host, went to the Palace Hotel and kind of like dissected the backstory, which was not that it was unsavory, as she would put it.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, the name of the dressing was actually derived from a movie that was kind of... She's part Indian. She's half Indian.
Sasha is.
And so the characters in this movie that feature the Green Goddess were pretty much all white British actors who were portraying Hindus.
Shades of Miss Saigon.
Yeah. And for her, it was like a big shock because she just always thought it was kind of this hippie grocery store dressing. Mm. And so for her, for part of her heritage to kind of be portrayed this way was, you know, it was just like... It was kind of a bit of a surprise for her. She just didn't expect it.
And Laura, there's a lot of overlap between the series that Susie's talking about and your book, Green Goddess Dressing, for example. Cioppino, another example. I either knew, didn't know, or I forgot that cioppino was created first here in San Francisco. Talk about the origin of that, if you would.
Sure. Cioppino is one of my super favorite original foods. It's why I spent my bachelorette party at Tadich Grill with waiters all over the age of 70, drinking a martini and wearing a bib, slurping my cioppino. It was created really by the Italian fishermen who would come to the shores of the bay.
Back when there were fishermen at Fisherman's Wharf.
Oh, right. Exactly. And there are some amazing old pictures that we found for the book of these old fishing boats. And it was, you know, prepared quite simply just using their catch and a few tomatoes and what was termed a sweet oil, which is really just olive oil. And that was pretty much it. It was quite simple. It's become a little more elaborate. But, you know, for me, growing up in Northern California, cioppino is just kind of what I think of when I think of San Francisco, cioppino, sourdough bread.
And what did you find, Susie, when you were doing that story for the California Report?
Well, Bianca Taylor, who is a former intern but is now a reporter with us, she's been actually tackling these. That cioppino, you know, it's kind of a disputed, it's disputed like how it was named.
I think it's, one of you described it as having fishy origins.
Fishy origins, exactly. I mean, I think that the story's basically right. You know, it was Italian fishermen. I think the name, we might have a cut, actually, that talks about the name of how cioppino was named.
One fisherman would toss a nice fat fish into the bucket, another would drop in a succulent Dungeness crab, another some herbs and vegetables. The cry that prompted each contribution was, chip in, chip in. But coming from an Italian throat, this American slang had to end in a vowel. So chip in-o was born.
And again, that was Mia Harriman, who's general manager of the restaurant Chipino. One theory there, Susie, about Chipino. I'm not sure I buy that one. But,
yeah, yeah. But I don't know.
It's a good story.
Yeah.
And, you know, Laura, to what extent, you know, a lot of these things like Martini, for example, sort of a classic case of there being several origin stories. How do you suss out like where the truth is? Or maybe it doesn't matter that much. It's just kind of fun to talk about it.
It's fun to talk about it. It's so important. You know, when Susie was talking about the origins of Chipino, that is the case with nearly every one of these original foods. They are hotly debated. There are, you know, several of them have been subjects of mock court trials between, you know, San Francisco and L.A. to duke it out.
What's an example of that?
The fortune cookie is one.
Martini
is another. Martini was really a battle royale between Martinez and San Francisco. I side with the Martinez origin story in the book, but I do acknowledge that it's really hard to prove. I'm not a historian, but historians even will tell you this, the ones that I interviewed for the book. So, Martinez is a fantastic sort of the people who side with the Martinez story. It's quite they're quite passionate about it.
And there's a bar where I think there's a isn't there a plaque or
there's
something?
Yeah, the bar no longer exists. The plaque is a little monument, a little sort of pile of rocks, essentially, that sits in a parking lot in Martinez. It has a real martini inside. it's cared for by the folks who really did all the research who live in Martinez. And it's, you know, it's a lot of fun to explore all the stories.
Well, I was surprised at how many variations there are on the martini as well.
So many. I wanted to bring a little sampling today, but we'll have to save that for another day. The Martinez is a bit sweeter than what you know to be the modern sort of dry martini, and it's because it is made with an old Tom gin. So it's a sweeter gin, still with dry vermouth, a little bit of orange bitters. But the origin story goes that a gold miner, recently flush with his, you know, with his findings, came through Martinez on his way to San Francisco and plunked down his gold nuggets and asked for something special. And that after a few of the martinis, his words became a little slurred and you can no longer really pronounce martini, but Martinez.
Okay. And Susie, you also did some investigation into Pisco Punch.
Yeah, that was the last piece of ours that aired. It actually aired last Friday, last weekend, by Carly Severin. And, you know, for me, editing those pieces, it was, you know, she brought up a lot of similarities with, like, tech and the gold rush. And so that drink, you know, in equivalent terms, cost $25, you know, during the gold rush days. And, you know, it's really similar to now. Like, we're willing to pay $25, $30 for...
Some people are.
Some people are for a high-end cocktail, you know. Yeah. And with Pisco, I should say, it had a secret ingredient. And the bar that the story is based around is only blocks from a bar that currently serves it in the financial district. So basically the bar that created it actually was in the footprint of the Transamerica Pyramid. And the bar that currently, you know, serves it, got the recipe, is only like a block or two away from it. So they're kind of like still trying to preserve the mystery ingredient in Pisco Punch. The original was a fortified wine that may or may not have had coca leaves involved. So you could only have two.
That would give it punch.
Yes, exactly. But they do still serve it now at the Comstock Saloon. They still won't divulge what their modern day secret ingredient is, but you can get a Pisco Punch downtown.
And what's the difference between a Pisco Punch and a Pisco Sour?
Well, the Pisco Sour was actually made in Peru. It's like a totally different drink.
Okay. We're talking with Susie Rocco, producer, director for KQED's California Report, and also producer of the series Golden State Plate, and Laura Smith Borman. Her new book is titled Iconic San Francisco Dishes, Drinks, and Desserts. We're going to open up the phone lines. Maybe you can Tell us some of your favorite iconic dishes. We all know about sourdough bread. We'll talk about that as well. The number 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum at kqed.org, or you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Laura, what is it about the Bay Area, do you think, that made it such a fertile territory for developing so many of these, you know, recipes, foods, you know, created foods like the Itzit and dressing, cocktails? What is it?
I asked myself that a lot as I was doing the research, and I think this is a place that is a celebration of many cultures. The Gold Rush represented a dream for many, so a lot of people not only came for the Gold Rush to mine for gold, but business people came along with that to, you know, to supply the miners. And so you had French bakers with bread and certainly something like the It's It, which,
you know, pronounced it. So it's pronounced It's It as opposed to It's It.
I don't know. It's It is what I
it's
say.
It's It. Okay.
It's
just
It.
Wondering.
That story goes that George Whitney, who owned Playland at the Beach, which, you know, was a big sort of, you know, fun festival at Ocean Beach, was trying to develop the perfect treat and, you know, put together a combination of oatmeal cookies and ice cream and finally dipped it in chocolate and said, that's it. And thus the name was born. But the It's It is a wonderful, its trajectory of its story is really amazing because though it didn't, it was born at Playland, it was really saved by an immigrant family, the Shamias, in the 70s when Playland closed and the business was up for sale and they were making their own version of the It's It that they called Jamal's Old Fashioned Ice Cream Sandwich, I think, after one of their kids. And people would come into their little pizza and liquor store and ask for an It's It. And when they saw that the company, the original It's It, was up for sale, they said, we need it. We have to have it.
And it's still like just south of the airport, isn't it?
It is. So they're in Burlingame.
And is it really just sort of a Bay Area thing, or has it gone nationwide or beyond?
It's a Bay Area thing. It's gone beyond the Bay Area, but they're quite careful about not having it everywhere. They really like that it's sort of word of mouth and that it has a cult following. Some people apparently serve, you know, a big tower of Itzits at their wedding. So they have, the family has lots of stories about, you know, all of their fanatics.
And we talked about bread, and I think in your book, Laura, you talk about, is it Isidore Boudin, I think, who created, you know, which is still around, that bakery,
yes,
right?
Yes, and that's a very delicious bread. They supply many of the restaurants throughout San Francisco. It's super sour, very tangy, chewy, delightful, but there even is conflict about where sourdough bread, you know, originated. Did it come from the French bakers, or is it something that's really a creation of the miners? And really, the debate is about the sourness and how well you can document historically taste. It's difficult to point to a certain bread from, you know, 1875 and say that was quite sour versus, you know, what was served at the World's Fair in 1915.
And it goes back all the way to the Gold Rush, right? I mean, what was it about
sure
the
does.
Gold Rush that, you know, did, was there some necessity to make bread in a certain way?
Sure. The miners in a number of places were believed to not have a steady supply of ingredients. So they developed bread using just a wild yeast, which is really just the air and flour and water. Erica Peters, who's a brilliant culinary historian, pointed out that the miners in Northern California actually did have a pretty steady supply of things like baking soda. So she believes that the mining history of sourdough comes from the Klondike Gold Rush, which was kind of around Alaska and Canada, because they were more remote and they didn't get things like baking soda.
Well, and of course, bread has been modernized, shall we say, by places like Tartine. Susie, we're either blessed or cursed for having Tartine Manufactory in the neighborhood a block away. And the original Tartine, I think it's the original, or maybe it was actually in like Mill Valley, but it's on 18th and Guerrero. I mean, people line up for, you know, almost an hour sometimes to get a loaf of their bread and sometimes take it back to New York or something. You know, it's just incredible the cachet that something so simple as bread has taken on.
Yeah. And they're opening tartines in Korea and Japan based on the reputation that they've built in San Francisco.
Talking about iconic San Francisco foods, if you want to join us, the number to call, 866-733-6786. Again, it's 866-733-6786. And feel free to tweet us your favorite made in the Bay Area foods. We've got one listener who tweets the crab sandwich at Nick's in Pacifica. And Crab Louie also, of course, is a Bay Area creation, right, Laura?
It is, yeah. Crab Louie, which the Louie refers to sort of the sauce that goes with the crab.
And there's dispute about how Louie is spelled, I guess.
There is. You see L-O-U-I-E or L-O-U-I-S. The sort of history behind that is there was a French chef who was at the Old Poodle Dog, who I will probably mangle his name, but Louis Coutard, I think. And he served kind of a spicy red, almost like a spicy Thousand Island dressing on his menu. But then it sort of quickly claimed a few years later by the St. Francis Hotel and Victor Hertzler, who I think shared a recipe with a writer at the time. And it was, you know, finally published. And so they're all disputed.
You talked about sort of that melding of cultures. And there are several iconic Chinese cuisine foods. You brought some fortune cookies in. Chop suey is another one. Talk about the evolution of that. And was it brought in its sort of original form by immigrants, or was it just like created here? I mean, where did the fortune cookie come from?
The fortune cookie is actually not Chinese. It's Japanese. So the first sort of production of the fortune cookie in America was done for the Japanese Tea Garden in Golden Gate Park. It was brought over. It was a cookie that was made in Japan, but kind of Americanized here.
I think it was more savory in Japan.
In Japan, it was more savory.
It was not sweet.
Mm-hmm, right. Makoto Hajiwara, I think, was the founder of the tea garden. And he brought his kata molds from Japan and I believe commissioned Benkyodo, which is still around. It's a Japanese sort of confectionery. They're known today for making beautiful mochi and manju. They no longer make fortune cookies, but they were the ones who used those special cookie molds from Japan to supply the Japanese tea garden.
So why is it that they're, you know, it's largely, think of it now, is a Chinese cuisine thing?
That's a good question.
Well, I mean, one of the it's a story that I'm actually researching for Golden mm-hmm. State Plate, and one of the theories is that during Japanese internment, this equipment was stored away, and so Chinese companies started to make them, you know, because the demand was still there. And so, you know, it's a long time for 42 to 44, where people were not, you know, accessing this equipment. So other people come in and take that on.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever gotten a fortune cookie at a Japanese restaurant.
No.
Do they still have? No, so that's over.
Yeah. And they tried to market them in China, and it didn't work.
Mm. All right, and now you can, of course, have custom-made fortunes, and they come in chocolate, I think, also, and I'm sure different
every
flavors.
Color. Every color.
Okay. All right, let's go to the phones, and Joe in San Francisco, you are first. Welcome.
How are you? I just wanted to talk about being the Bay Area native. We've got Round Table Pizza that was created in Menlo Park. Yeah. We have Ghirardelli chocolate. We have the burrito. The burrito was born in San Francisco.
In the Mission, I guess.
I challenge you to find. Yeah, yeah. What else? We've got the Alpine Inn in Portola Valley. They've got it's a rectangular burger. It's as good as it gets, right?
Yeah, yeah. An embarrassment of riches. I didn't know that about Round Table.
I didn't either.
I have to say, I'm a little Star fan, I guess. And Pauline's, but unfortunately, they've closed. And, you know, speaking of, we have to mention this sort of iconic foods, We found out yesterday, Susie, the newsroom was in mourning that Luca, yes, the Italian deli on, I think it's 22nd in Valencia, is going to be closing.
One of my favorite places, and then kind of one of those old school places, those, you know, it was 94 years old. And it was one of the things that I associated most about the old, you know, heart of that neighborhood, you know, in the Mission. It's hard to actually think of that part of Valencia without Luca there. And now I'm like, where am I going to get my sandwiches?
Yeah, there is another Luca on Chestnut. I think they're not related to each other.
Yeah, I'm not really sure.
And Joe, you mentioned Ghirardelli chocolate. Anytime you go into Nancy Pelosi's office in D.C., and probably here as well, there's bowls of Ghirardelli chocolate. She's a dark chocolate fan, but also, of course, it is her hometown. So Ghirardelli is really an iconic name. I mean, it's not necessarily, some would say, the best chocolate, but, you know, a lot of people, including our Speaker of the House, think that it is certainly a local favorite. All right, Joe, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Rob in San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you. I've got another chocolate one for you, which is Guittard. But the Irish coffee, was that invented at the Buena Vista?
That's the story, right? Herb Cain, I think, made that famous, but you're both shaking your heads.
Yeah, that was a Bay Curia story that we, you know, re-aired recently. But it was born in Ireland, but it was you know, brought over to the Buena Vista, who made it quite famous.
It was an import, a real import here. And that is, I think, a perfect drink. It's something that's great for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. you have your coffee and your whiskey all at once, but that's true.
Yeah, Herb Cain definitely, I think, promoted the myth, I guess, that it was created there.
Sure.
And I'm sure he wrote a lot about martinis as well. He was known for having one or two of those at lunch. We are going to continue talking with Susie Racho and Laura Smith-Borman about iconic San Francisco foods. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. And let's go back to the phones, and we're going to go up to San Rafael and Tristan. Welcome.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to give a shout-out to the cheese world. We have a Telemé cheese that was first made in Tamales, California by Greek immigrants.
Okay, that's a good one. Had you heard about that
one?
I loved Telemé cheese when I was a kid, but didn't know that it was original to the area.
And another?
Yeah, it came in early 1900s.
Well, there is such an artisanal cheese, like, industry in the tradition. Bay Area, tradition. I mean, are there other cheeses that that you are aware of that were created here first?
Well, I don't think of specific cheeses that were born here, but businesses that have really sort of shaped the culture of the area. And
Cowgirl Creamery, for one.
Cowgirl Creamery, long before Cowgirl, the cheese board in Berkeley. And they were really sort of part of this movement of, you know, small food businesses that supported each other, and their bread, their sourdough is really beautiful. Thing. And they, you know, the cheese board and Acme, also in Berkeley, kind of predate Tartine, and kind of, I think, are what make places like Tartine, you know, able to flourish.
Absolutely. Tristan, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to another Joe, but a Joey in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention the people behind the food and beverage that you guys are talking about that makes the Bay Area incredibly unique and special in the world. I mean, you have people like Jeremiah Tower, Wolfgang Puck, Mark Miller, Alice Waters, and now the new guard of chefs who are spawning younger chefs that inoculate the whole world with ways of thinking about food that are really special to the Bay Area. I mean, Wolfgang Puck, you could say, is from L.A., but he got his inspiration from Alice Waters for the pizza that made him famous.
Yeah, and good point. But, you know, I was thinking, too, as I read your book, Laura, that, you know, what Joey's describing are, you know, as part of the sort of California cuisine, locally grown, farm to table, high end. But a lot of these things we're talking about are really, they're not, they're sort of more accessible, you could say,
to
more people.
They're simple foods, many of them, maybe minus the pisco that was super expensive back in its day. But yeah, that's what draws me to these foods, and to your point, to the people who are kind of keeping them going, and to the places like Luca. You know, that's sort of what drives me. Is I'm not a historian. I'm a nostalgist, you know, and I really want these places to persist. And it feels like a loss of a family member when you hear about a closure.
Great raviolis.
Yeah. Great.
Among other things. All right. Thanks for the call. We've got some comments from our listeners. Mari writes, See's Candy could sort of qualify as a Bay Area specialty. It was founded in L.A. in 1921, but has been located in South San Francisco for a long time. I send it to family in Central America every year, she writes, and the quality is fantastic, never changes, and has really persisted, in, to use your word, in light of all the sort of high-end chocolates and candies. See's is still a brand that people know.
Sure is. I mean, it's in a number of airports. It is the thing that my mother always gives us on Easter.
There you go. And then Mitch writes, with the recent explosion of boutique ice creams in San Francisco, it's easy to forget the original classic and still best Mitchell's ice cream over on Guerrero. They're unique, I think, in part, Susie, because of the flavors. A lot of Filipino fruit that they use, or Asian kind of flavors.
Yeah,
is that right?
You know, at one point that was they had a lot of. The neighborhood has changed a lot, and they did have a lot more Filipino population there, so they developed a lot of Filipino flavors. So, you know, you have a halo-halo flavor, or a macapuno, which is young coconut, or ube, which is huge now. Everybody's making an ube.
That's the purple one?
Purple root vegetable. Yeah. And so, which is now, like, gone super mainstream, but they were one of the first to make an ube ice cream. And also, speaking about ice cream, you know, one of the next pieces we're going to do, Sasha Coca is actually taking on the Rocky Road debate.
Somebody had to do it.
Yes. And so, it, you know, the argument is whether or not Fenton's created it, or whether or not Dreyer's created it. And it's two Oakland companies that had a connection. And so, who did it first?
We're getting to the end of the hour. But Susie, I know you're also you're looking into Mai Tais, or have you done that already? Was that part of the series?
That's a story I'm going to be reporting. And we're going to be doing Mai Tais. We're going to be doing fortune cookies. We do California. So the next piece we're going to air is about ranch dressing. So our next piece on Friday is about the real Hidden Valley Ranch, which was in Santa Barbara County. And we've just got a whole bunch more ready to go.
Well, we brought all these fortune cookies in, so I got to open one up here. My fortune is. Be prepared to modify your plan. It'll be good for you. All right. I guess that's positive. I'll keep that in mind. Thank you both so much for coming in. Laura Smith Borman, her book is called Iconic San Francisco Dishes, Drinks, and Desserts. And our own Susie Racho, producer, director of the California Report. Look out for their series, The Golden State Plate. Thank you both so much, and thanks for the treats that it has not melted yet, so I think we're going to probably get around to eating that pretty darn soon. Thanks so much for listening. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny, who returns tomorrow. Have a great day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.